Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday. Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone. And from for our viewers of Far East, good night.
Welcome everyone to our last episode of season one, and I'm really happy to see how many amazing speakers we had in this season. So stay till the end. Time flies, and it seems like we just started yesterday. And for those who are new with us, I'd like quickly just to say, what are we doing on this program on Swiss Impact with Banerjee? So we share with you the fastest growing sector impact investing and the businesses which have the best future. We talk about what is it, impact investing, how to raise awareness, how can you learn about that? How can you learn from inspiring examples from people, thought leaders, world leaders who are already engaged? So Ben, as a tradition, maybe you will share with us a little story before we jump into the show.
Of course. So I remember in Netherlands, that was quite a very many years ago, there was a self-named medium, Yomanda, who gave spiritual medicines and advices to people. And she did it to one Dutch actress, Sylvia Millekamp. So Yomanda gave her, Sylvia was suffering with terminal breast cancer, and Yomanda gave her spiritual medicines and advices. And somehow, because of that, Sylvia refused chemotherapy, which resulted in Sylvia dying of the cancer. Okay. Similarly, I look at climate change like the same. It's a deadly cancer threatening our planet, and the big businesses and the financial institutions are using ESG, impact investment, sustainable investment as a sort of placebo effect to distract us from knowing what is really going on, or to give us a kind of false hope and feeling that we are doing it fine. So I want to start with an apology. Last week, I mentioned during the same like story like today that it seems that the financial sector has woken up. But unfortunately, the facts show...
They are still sleeping.
Exactly. The facts show otherwise. The fact is that most of the big businesses and financial sectors are still playing the old game and doing this damage in ever-increasing speed to our climate. And in fact, also indirectly, they are damaging climate actions and impactful businesses and funds. So today I'm going to propose something very, very radical.
Oh. I mean, for those who don't know, Ben is known for amazingly depressing stories, but with great
Thank you.
Facts. But I'm also quite radical, so it sounds awesome to me. So I like when people understand what is what and are not hiding behind nice terms such as impact investing and doing completely something else in reality. So tell us, what do you suggest?
So I think maybe it's a high time that the democratic governments should take control over the financial institutions, especially the big ones, and they should motivate or punish big businesses. So for motivation, they should use things like tax cuts and punish with penalties. And why do I come to this opinion? Reason is simple. This is one of the lessons we learned from the COVID, that when a systemic crisis hits, the government should take charge. And as they are the only ones who have comprehensive resources needed to come forward with systemic solutions. The big businesses and institutions, financial institutions, had no issues but sitting back and letting the governments take control to bring the pandemic under control. And stronger the government, like China, the faster the pandemic was under control, whether by using restricted travels, mandatory masks, social distancing, etc. The only support private sector in this case could give was to support the government. Similarly, scientists have been warning for decades that the climate change is a far greater systemic risk. So why don't the business just sit back and let the governments flatten the greenhouse emission curve, which is increasing as we speak? Instead, they are being controlled and lobbied by big businesses. Their control is quite very easily visible in countries like in the United States and in Germany.
Oh, I tell you, businesses are going to hate you for this suggestion. You basically suggest that we should stop believing the illusion repeatedly promoted by global business leaders and the controlled democratic governments that free market will save us from climate crisis without government action.
Exactly. Yes, that's what I mean. Climate change requires similar actions to flatten the greenhouse gas emission. This is a greater threat, like I mentioned, and it is going to cause a far greater damage to us than COVID did, and it will cost far higher to fix. Unfortunately, the governments have not acted yet. Why? Because I, in my opinion, these are two reasons. One is that the Western governments, our democracies, are quite very much hijacked by big businesses, multinationals, and the other governments still do not know how to act when a crisis takes decades to take place or hit, and not like COVID, which hit in a few weeks.
Okay, we got it. What about radical solution for financial sector? I'm scared, but tell us.
So financial sector, if you look at history, has only one purpose, and that is to make profit and make it fast. So fund managers are financially incentivized and legally obliged to focus on monetary value, but not on social or environmental values.
I can add to that they also have been spreading the propaganda for decades that the free market can correct itself.
That's exactly my point. Look at it. When subprime hit us, the subprime crisis, the market proved that the market, free market, could not correct itself from a market failure crisis or an issue. And climate change is the biggest market failure that we are heading for. So of course, we also take their advice and make the market, or I would say if we take their advice and make the market completely free, there will be no market left. So you see, when COVID hits, look at the speed and the laws that the governments used, extraordinary laws to control the spread of the COVID. God forbid if the free market would have been in control at that moment to save us from COVID. So businesses, and going back a little bit in history of other businesses, businesses are created to tend for their stakeholders. Unfortunately, the Western capitalism has completely distorted and corrupted it. It has become, businesses or the financial institutions have become for short-term gain and fast and only profit-oriented. So it is only the governments who can now make the difference, using taxes, regulations to rein in the businesses to reduce the carbon emission. In my opinion, the public and private sector should work together, but under the leadership of the government. The government should lead the way, especially democratically elected leaders. And I certainly propose to exclude the democratic leaders, the so-called democratic leaders who are influenced are the lobby of big businesses. So that was my short speech for today. I think I'm one of the most hated men soon.
Wow, yeah. And I'm curious to see how many big businesses and banks will want such invasion from the government voluntarily. So guys, you still have time to act. The ban's proposition, the radical one, is not yet implemented. So maybe move on your own till we have this really in place and you will be forced acting.
I just wanted to add to it, Svetlana, I didn't specify voluntarily, because I'm sure the business and the financial institutions will not work voluntarily. The governments have to take actions with strict mandatory regulations. So yeah, I wanted to say, since you are the banking and the financial expert, last week you explained to us all what is the difference between philanthropy and impact investment. So I would propose that if today you can explain what is the difference between sustainable investment and impact investment in a language which people like me can understand?
All right, all right. Then let's keep it also short, because I usually the audience anyway remembers 2% of what was said. So in a very simple language, sustainable investments, they apply certain criteria like ESG, environmental, social, governance criteria, to select the best companies which, for example, reduce CO2 emissions or reduce waste, or maybe they apply even gender equality policies and put more women into top positions at banks or companies, right? But still, they have the profit as first, so they are not mission-driven. Compared to impact investment, which make this big step forward, and they have an underlying mission, which we usually determine by sustainable development goals, the 17 SDGs, which are like accessible education, accessible healthcare, action for climate change, for our oceans, justice, and so on. There are 17 goals like that. So basically, these are innovative enterprises which incorporate emission, and they are financially self-sustainable. So it's not a philanthropy, right? So it's still a business, but mission-driven business. We generate both social and environmental impact and profit. And this impact can be measured. So it is a measurable impact which is created. So I think I stop here, a little input on sustainability and impact here. Maybe a little added thing to that. So sustainability, sustainable investment, create broad impact. We need it, as big corporation can create huge impact because they're big. But we also need impact investing, which generates deeper impact, systematic change, transforming lifestyles, transforming systems. And it really changes lives of people and life of our planet, which is so much needed. And unfortunately, capital in impact investing is still quite low compared to sustainable investing. So what we are trying to do is to shift more capital from sustainable to impact investing, so that people understand what is what and take the right action. Ben?
Thank you.
Anything else to add here?
No, I just wanted to say, if you can tell us a little bit about who we are training the businesses to understand that.
Yeah, sure. So can you see the slide of the program? Yeah, okay. So actually, it's also what we are teaching with Ben together, the businesses. How can you incorporate impact into your business and make it not only profitable, but also impactful? So it's both. How do you generate social and environmental impact and financial return at the same time? And so at this course, we teach you how also to structure and scale your business. If you have already one, how do you transform that it also generate positive social and environmental impacts? And moreover, how do you fundraise? Because many of businesses, existing or new ones, they are struggling with fundraising. How to find funds in this sector? How do you attract money from impact investors? And do it successfully. So we guide you hand in hand to your success during this course. And of course, it's not only about money, it's also about how to get expertise in this amazing and growing sector. So this course was on 1st of April, so just yesterday, but there are much more to come. So just check our website frequently, camomile.ch in events, or you can also go to impactinvestingschool.com, where you have the whole overview of our courses. Ben, anything to add here?
No, I'm just, everybody is welcome to join us. This is absolutely perfect. And we are training all over the world thanks to the webinar now.
So the today's show is about a summary of our five last episodes. And enjoy that. Ben is very quick sometimes, but today is about still the past, but amazing past, where you can still learn a lot from our speakers, like investor Kevin Harrington, Martin Palmer from Fate Invest, and other speakers. So enjoy And if you can always watch the whole episode if you're interested in this one. All right, enjoy the show.
Thank you very, very much.
To start, a little bit of impact investment from my side, I actually wanted to share some of the history about impact investing and provide a little sustainable journey about its creation and related terms like corporate social responsibility and sustainable investing. So actually, the very beginning of what we name responsible or sustainable goes back to biblical times. The Jewish law has established at that time directives concerning ethical investment. And the use of money was considered as the second most important subject of the New Testament teachings in the mid-1700s by the initiator John Wesley. Furthermore, religious investors whose traditions embrace peace and nonviolence, they kept away from investing in enterprises that profited from products designed to enslave or harm human beings. If you are familiar, I'm sure nowadays all businesses have corporate social responsibility. Some of them are really meaning it and implying at their businesses. Some are using it as a marketing tool or like must have. Anyway, the first mention of corporate social responsibility or CSR can be traced back to the year 1950. And the public concern raised in 1980s much further because there were such events like apartheid in South Africa when millions of people, churches, universities had their center of attention in investment strategies attempting to influence and force the white minority government to destroy the inhuman political system in this country. After there have been such events like Chernobyl and even in Switzerland, we had a disastrous event in 1986 when there was a chemical factory at the Sandoz which caused Rhine pollution and dramatically influenced the environment. So, and let's jump now to sustainability. The sustainability was actually or became internationally recognized after the report of the United Nations of 1987, which was called Our Common Future. And sustainability refers to development that meets needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So basically, if we live today, we should live in a way that our children would still be able to live at least the way we do, or even better, right? And finally, coming to impact investing a term, it was originally defined in 2007, so now 14 years ago, by the Rockefeller Foundation, and they define it as investments made with intention to generate both financial return and social and environmental impact. Global Impact Investing Network then added few words to this definition. So now our accepted definition around the world is that impact investments are investments made with the intention to generate positive, measurable social and environmental impact alongside a financial return. And if we translate it to more simple words, basically you invest in innovative social enterprises which have an underlying mission to solve one or several SDGs and generate positive social and environmental impacts, of course, financial return as well, which can be measured. Actually, for that, I would need sunglasses back, you know, like we go to Mauritius, amazing. We have snow in Switzerland, but I would love to go to Mauritius. And it's not only amazingly beautiful country, but it also has quite a unique history. So today I'm a history geek. So a little fact, although it was known by the Malay traders as far back as 10th century, but it remained uninhabited actually till 16th century. And then what it was explored by Portuguese and settled by the Dutch and named after the Prince Maurits of Nassau. It got its independence in 1968 And now it has a stable democracy with regular free election and positive human rights record. And the country has attracted considerable foreign investment and has one of Africa's highest per capita incomes.
So today, we will listen to one of the leaders on the topic of agriculture, climate change, and women empowerment in Africa. She is well known and a leader in this sector. So with this, we welcome the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius, Her Excellency Professor Dr. Amina Gurib Fakim.
Welcome, Amina.
Thank you. Thank you to the Banerjees for having me on your show.
Good evening. Good evening. Already evening, right?
Yes, yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for making the time free for our program, and our global audience is truly appreciating that you could join us today. And in my personal opinion, I mean, you are such an inspiring woman, president, scientist, professor. Wow. How could you do that all in one life? Yes, exactly. So on this slide, you can see how the world soon will look like, right? So because of your immense experience and experience as a president of a country, especially in the field of agriculture, women empowerment, and all over Africa, I'd like to ask you if we can focus on this topic, agriculture and woman empowerment today. And of course, climate change, how it influences Mauritius and what we can do about that.
No, but the map you have shown, in fact, it is very, very worrying. And I'd like to mention up front that Africa, of which, of course, we politically belong to, is not a net emitter of greenhouse gas. But as you will see, as you have seen already, and the projections are there, that the continent is going to be very, very badly impacted. So increasingly, the conversation around Africa is we are looking for climate justice. And this is something that we can talk about later on, which will be the subject of our talk today. They are manifold. And already we're saying that it is impacting, you have mentioned drought, you have mentioned cyclone, you have mentioned flooding. And I think over the past 5 years, we have seen all these happening in the region. While Australia was witnessing severe fires, the east coast of Africa was underwater. While Australia was experiencing a severe drought, we were experiencing a terrible cyclone in the Southwest Indian Ocean. So this is where I think we're talking about the effect of the El Niño and the El Niño, as we say. And so this is all boils down to, to a large extent, to the climate. And as we are a small island state, we are impacted otherwise, because 10 to 12% of the population's protein source come from the sea. And we're seeing a lot of coral bleaching because of the high temperature of the water and also the absorbance of carbon dioxide, which makes the water acidic. So higher temperature means more violent cyclone and coral bleaching. And of course, as you know, that the coral reef, they occupy about, I think, less than 2%, if I state correctly, but over 25% of the biodiversity, the life on this planet will be revolving around the coral reef.
So the question would be, because you mentioned that hybrid seeds, right? And actually farmers have to buy them every year because they only can use it once. And then the consequence is that their stocks decrease over time and they have no possibility to go back to the traditional way of farming. So what would be the solution for these issues and that the biodiversity is prevailed?
I think the issue confronting farmers on the continent, as I said, is water, access to water. And this is not something that has been really been addressed in many of the models that have been laid down. We have talked a lot about seed production, and there has been a move at some point to help bring seeds out onto the continent. But one thing, as a scientist, I have some concern here, because when you look at hybrid seeds, which are brought in, they will ensure one crop, one harvest, yeah, maybe two harvests. But what happens to the diversity of the crops which are there? What happens to the plants which have been there for long, that have resisted the changes, the climate change which is happening? And I feel that, you know, this is where the indigenous crops that we have should be looked at. The seeds have to be protected, and this is where we need to start developing seed banks and mm-hmm. access of these farmers to these original seeds. And unfortunately, it has become a big business by some big corporation. And we need to look at very, very carefully. Why we need to look that very carefully? Because this diversity, as I said up front earlier in the conversation, is only found in the tropics. Unfortunately, our food, the way we feed ourselves, we rely on about 20 crops, right? And there is such a diversity in Africa. Now, if I go back to one country, which was of India in the 1980s, when the Green Revolution was just starting there in Punjab, they had identified over 50,000 rice species, right? And by the time they have gone through, and now if you look at the way rice has been planted in that part of the world, they're relying on just about 40 species or 40 varieties of rice. So what happened to the rest? Now, the problem is not just so much the harvest, because I'm sure they're getting good harvest from these 40 species. I'm thinking within a changing climate, assuming you get the agriculture COVID, it wipes off all the species, what happens then? So that's why I had joined movements in the past to start saving the seeds, to start mm-hmm. saving the indigenous plants, to start saving mm-hmm. seeds all over the place to do that. I'm sorry about that.
You have a cool cat. Biodiversity in animals.
So this is what we need to do, is to protect the seeds locally and also to protect the seeds regionally, because there has to be exchanges in the various in the climatic conditions where these plants are growing. Now, I'll tell you a small story, is that there was at some point a very bad rust infection in Canada, in wheat. And they were looking for that gene that could save the plantation. And you know where they found it? They found it out in Turkey, because they were doing the same kind of work, and they were actually, you know, collecting the species and doing all this. So this is why we need to safeguard this germplasm, because we don't know what tomorrow is made of. Yeah.
Going a little bit towards a disastrous scenario, like, is there any projection, if we continue the same way, for how many years Mauritius can be there and it's still possible to live there and see the corals, the biodiversity? So how bad are the forecasts if we continue the same way? They don't change.
Well, if we look at the report from the IPCC, the climate change, we were at risk, but we have put in measures which we can adapt. We are not that low. If you look at Maldives, for example, they're very, very low, 3 meters above sea. So we're not there yet. So I think if we are going to look at the whole situation positively, hopefully, if we adapt, if we take the measures at the international level, we should be able to overcome this, because nature regenerates very fast, but we have to give her a chance. And if we give her a chance, we will survive, because this is our livelihoods that we are safeguarding.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe on my background, I've basically always been an entrepreneur. When I started my business career, working for about 10 years for Nestlé, the food business all over the world, quite a long time also running businesses in Africa. And then I developed a financial company in Liechtenstein, which my family is now the majority owner, which actually has as purpose, we call it wealth preservation. We are mainly working with family businesses, trying to help them and to find structures to keep their assets, their businesses over generations. It is surprising generation giving, a very sustainable issue, not only environmentally, but also socially and financially. And, you know, it's very important to have consistent businesses. And I would say that the family businesses are the most sustainable business in all aspects, which we have. I then developed, because I was not very happy with the situation of information, I developed a network and a publishing work and consulting work, which we call Geopolitical Intelligence Services. There we run a network of about 180 experts worldwide who give us background information and future scenarios. Mm-hmm. Svetlana, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, it was a bit breaking. Was it 180? You say
180, yeah.
180 experts, okay.
180. And giving background information and future scenarios. These are all people who have great experience, great knowledge, and also themselves a good network. And then finally, I did also some impact work. Well, I think also any company you are running and creating is an impact work. But I did also, I was very interested, like other ones, in the problem of health. Mm-hmm. And we have seen that basically our society, we have an aging society, we will not be able anymore to meet the health costs. Problem is also, most of the healthcare system is actually a sick care system. And so
yes,
we thought,
absolutely, I agree with that.
Yeah. Something in the preventive health, sort of to prevent people getting sick, and mainly also to delay, to increase the health span, not necessarily the lifespan, but the health span of people, and delaying or avoiding the entrance of these age-related chronic diseases like cancer, cardiovascular, diabetes, etc. We are doing a lot of, the West is doing a lot of mistakes with treating Russia.
I completely
think the
agree.
Whole sanction policy is wrong. So certainly, well, I don't agree with what happened in Ukraine, obviously, and it's not. But the sanction policy, and I think the West would have great interest to be in good relationship with Russia. And I think this is also one side which is also very important, how this will be handled. We have, for the financial sector, we have, I think, a lot of part of the financial sector and the players there are quite outdated. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of reform necessary. But we have to see two things. We have to see the monetary policy in general, which I think is very dangerous at the moment. There's too much money around. There's a very, I think, a nearly irresponsible policy by central banks and a debt policy by the government. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite irresponsible. So the value of the money is in danger. And I don't know how that will end, this policy. But, you know, we had times, let's say, where the money policies and money was blown up artificially. We had it in France in the early 18th century, which finally led to the French Revolution. We had that, and I can't see how that will end well. I think the modern monetary theory is, let's say, a witch doctor, a hopeful thing.
How do you see the world in 2030?
I'll completely agree to Michael on all those points, because we have also had
this
discussion.
That's very easy. No, that's too easy.
Yeah, exactly. Especially about Russia and China. But I'll try to just keep focused on one point, and that's the economic point. What COVID has made us see that we can have all kind of predictions we want, but the nature of the environment has to throw one curveball, and our all production predictions disappear. Despite of all our knowledge, intelligence, the global economy shrank more than 4% last year. So this, and this pandemics and the frequency of pandemics are getting faster. I don't know if you're aware, that last year we had two pandemics. The other one was very strong also, which happened in China. Luckily, it did not spring from animals to human. If it would have sprung, then we would have had, again, a major serious problem. It was contained with a complete, China had to reduce its swine population very significantly to control that pandemic. So we are getting this one after another coming, as Lord Attenborough also recently mentioned, because you had the swine flu, SARS, Ebola, now we have COVID, and God forbid if the next pandemic has the mortality of Ebola or something. I mean, the mortality ratio, because COVID has a very, very low mortality ratio. So looking at all this, and then I look at the world leaders, and especially us, the enlightened West, I'm not very hopeful at this moment still how we are going to manage it. So I know that the governments of different, how the governments have acted on the pandemic for different countries, a debatable issue. In all countries, we can debate whether in India they did it right or not by stopping. You all must have read about what happened in India, then what happened in America, Europe. It has not been homogeneous. Every government has acted differently. But the economy has suffered and small businesses have been pushed under. If you look at just in New York, the Wall Street may be doing amazing, but there is so much bankruptcies and so many small and middle class businesses have been hit. And somehow we forget that this is the backbone of most of the economies, whether we are talking about US, Europe, China, India, and they have been the most severely devastated by this pandemic. So I think in conclusion, I'll keep it short, otherwise, like Prince Michael said, we will be running out of time, is I think in the next 10 years, we will have more localization of the supply chain. So what Prince Michael mentioned very quickly, a kind of anti-globalization movement, which I think already has started and will just go further. I think COVID has basically accelerated it. Less use of a lot of fossil fuel-based industries, that's including aviation and all that. Production is going to become more, people are going to be more think better before going into production supply or production lines. Less exporting of dirty products and more control on investment. And I'm focusing mainly on the finance, and this will come later on during the discussion. The finance is going to be more and more regulated and more controlled. So at least that's what I just want to say for the moment, that the situation is far worse than we think it is, and especially it is man-made. It was a report published, I think in the UN, but I'll come to that later, that 68% of our wildlife is gone in the last three decades. And this is mainly because of the loss of habitats, wildlife trading, and pollution. And also Professor Bradshaw from Australia mentioned that the scale of damage and threat to the biosphere and life form is so great that it's difficult to grasp even for well-informed experts. And another scientist also mentioned that the mainstream is largely unaware of the extent of damage, and the world leaders need a cold shower as the current environmental conditions are far worse than we are made to believe or what we are reading about. And this there was a report published, I think, 2 weeks ago or something in Davos by the United Nations and climate expert. I can send it to you later. So, and that also says, and that says that we are used to more about thinking the last 10, 15 years that the climate change is going to be gradual. This report said, no, it will not be gradual. It will be sudden and it will be cataclysmic. Because in the Russia, you are having this permafrost, which is melting fast. And the moment it releases the methane, there will be a complete loss of ice on Earth, which will mean we are not talking about a gradual increase of seawater level with 20 or 30% by the end of the century. We are talking about a seawater level of increase of 30 meters within a week. And this will be unstoppable. So we are at that brink at this moment.
I would agree to that. And I think it will also not start with a big plan, because if we look at Europe, the whole thing started with smaller experiences. There was this community on coal and steel in the 1950s. There was the Benelux Agreement.
Yeah.
And so it started out actually on an agreement of the first six, and then it became bigger. So I could imagine that also in Africa it might start, and also with a more regional collaboration, and then getting larger on that basis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't also, just like Michael, I don't see this union coming too quick and too fast, and certainly not like you.
It took in Europe, it's also already going for 70 years.
A long time.
We have very strong opinion
and
on
it's
that.
Still far from the goal.
Okay, then from the union, let's go to Italy. We have also interesting questions. Dear Ben and Prince Michael, I would like to know your opinion about the Italian management of migration from Africa. And the second part of the question is, moreover, how could you rely to the declaration you want us to worry about the end of the world when we are worried about the end of the week? What would you say? So the first part was about Italian management of migration from Africa. What is your opinion on that?
You want me to start on that?
Or shall I start?
Why don't you start? Why don't you start?
Okay, so, I can be much more... I think it's a serious case of mismanagement, but it's not only Italy, it involves the whole EU. We have had this problem. We saw this problem coming, we predicted this problem, and we did nothing about it. And even today we have, as a European Union, it's a mess. We don't even know whether we apply the Dublin Treaty or we don't, once we want to apply it, once we don't want to apply it. So I have very different opinion about how it is being managed in Italy. And I'm sure that Italian government or the Italian authorities have their own logic or their own reasons for doing what they are doing. But somehow I don't see that. And also, I think the problem should be looked into. I think EU has also mentioned a couple of times this problem should be looked from the EU perspective, how EU is going to manage it, but not in the way that EU Commission is pushing it through, by enforcing countries to fulfill their wishes. You can't enforce it. So in that way, I'm not a fan of governments of Hungary or Poland, but I think they have the full right to say, sorry, here we refuse to cooperate, like Hungary did. So EU Commission, I think, overstepped its borders by trying to enforce this thing. So it is a very complicated problem which has to be dealt by whole of Europe, but Europe has to think similar. And in this way, I think the same like Michael, EU is not an institution or organization which can think as one. It is still too much people having their own national ideas, national views, and still acting on it and working on it. So I think that was the most tactical answer I could give on international TV. But
colleagues, friends, whatever, in the financial sector, you know, what do they say? Is it possible that financial sector in Switzerland would transform when it's going to transform and be more sustainable, be more into impact investment?
Well, I think it does, and it happens. Because they want to invest, and there are more and more also of the banks or institutional ones who are looking for impact investments. Mm-hmm. Some doing strong. There's a trend going there, and I think it will also happen by necessity, because the economy is transforming for all sorts of different reasons, new technologies. Also a climate, changes in the society, and that needs adaptation. And I think we will get a much more bigger focus in the future on innovation and smaller and medium-sized companies than just the very large public companies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a trend, but these trends take always some time.
Right.
Because it needs a rethinking.
Ben, how do you see that?
I think I agree to what Michael is saying, but I think it does need a nudge, the financial sector, once in a while, because I have a very strong opinion about the financial sector.
Tell us, the strong opinions are welcome here.
So I think in the last few decades, the financial sector has changed. It used to be a service provider to real economy and society, and now it has become a very dominating and profit-seeking sector. If I watch the old films, one of the main activity of a bank was to lend money to small businesses, medium businesses. We are talking mainly about the SMEs. But today we have a sort of shadow banking with financial institutions, equity funds, trusts, and investment funds. And then came insurance, pension, and real estate. So we have a knock, and now even the fintech is in their hand. So they are using this power. This sector determines where the investments are going, who the lenders are going to be, and where the loans are going to be created. And these changes didn't just appear from one day to another. They have been gradual changes through many years. Laws, accounting rules, institutions, etc., have changed. And there hasn't been too much social discussions about this. And I also saw, because I was busy with this sector, that a lot of laws from US has been greedily adopted by the EU without the politicians, all the unions, all the bureaucrats really understanding the long-term consequences of these laws. And banks are still the lenders to businesses, but their earning models have changed. Their earning model seems to be now have finally fundamentally shifted to speculative financial products and non-productive, credits. And it is now the shareholders who are determining the policies now, and not the credit rating of the loan or of the lending process. And this has impacted the business, where the primary goal of the business used to be to make more innovation, make better products. And now the business is thinking about how to pay back his lender all the time, which is often the bank or a private equity organization. So here I agree to Michael when he says that unlimited money printing through credit without a clear goal or political or social control does not do well. But on the other hand, I seem to have this kind of feeling that politicians have lost control or any idea of the financial world. I come from Netherlands, which is a very, very vibrant democracy with a very powerful and very advanced financial sector. But Netherlands is soon facing an election, and I was going through the party programs, which I always do before the voting comes. Not one party mentions the financial system or the financial sector, what they plan to do or what their policies are about that. So there may be, I see it as two reasons. Either the politicians have become too lazy to give it over to the financial sector, or they are too scared to take on such a powerful lobby. So in my opinion, as long as this sector is not tamed or brought under control, the social inequalities will keep on increasing, climate change will not be attended to, and social development will suffer. And at the end of the day, it's always the citizens who have to take the loss. Sorry for this long monologue. So this was my idea about the financial sector.
Yeah. Michael, do you have anything to comment on that?
No, I think I would rather agree with that.
All right. Yes. I take another question from the audience, because as we were talking about small businesses, and here is a question to you, Michael. How is the Vaduz Technopark coming up? Are you inviting startups at Liechtenstein to work and develop global startups?
The Technopark, I haven't seen that, but I think it is doing pretty well. There were a lot of startups coming, and the good thing is that there we don't mind if somebody also does not succeed. They have an opportunity to start, and we all know that it might not be necessarily the success, and that's why it's good that there's an infrastructure there, so that it doesn't need big investments for somebody trying to do some business there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically, anyone can join the Technopark.
I don't know what exactly the rules are, but I think it is.
thank you very much. I am not 30 years old when I was sent by the Swiss Development Corporation to Africa. I was working, I'm an agriculture engineer as for profession. And then I worked there in agriculture research, and I came back to Switzerland, and I was looking around to work in development cooperation. I didn't want to work in research anymore. And then I thought it would be interesting also to get to know the other side. I worked with the government, in a government institution in the Cameroon, and then I had the opportunity and I think I would not regret it because it allowed me to see now different side of development cooperation. Then afterwards I decided to go back to the Swiss Development Corporation, where I then made my steps up to where I am now.
When I started out through a non-profit called Dolma Foundation, and then in 2014, once I felt the peace process, which was mentioned, sort of completed in 2008, by 2014, it was clear that the country was going to remain stable, or at least not slip back into conflict. And that's the point of where the private sector can really enter. So that was when we launched the first Dolma Impact Fund One, with mostly European development finance institutions as our investors, as well as family offices and high net worth individuals. And we've been investing ever since. We have done very well, both commercially and from an impact perspective. And I'm sure we'll talk about those in more detail, but it is.
Can you tell us what are the initiatives that your embassy is doing in Nepal?
Nepal was probably the first country Switzerland engaged in development cooperation at the time because it was so similar. So we started with cheese, you know, with the things we knew how to do, you know, like we planted in the mountain areas. And I think as Nepal evolved and transformed, we also changed, of course, our collaboration with Nepal. I would say regarding one of the success stories we can take also credit is the reforestation. In the 70s, the hills were totally deforested. And the UK, DFID at the time, and the SDC have contributed to deforestation by introducing community forestry so that the people were owned somehow the resources. So I would say that was really one of the success stories can be proud of. The other was we started very early with road construction because we believe that without roads there is no market development. So we were the first really who built the north-south road access to the China border and then also east-west in the hills. We have been from the beginning in technical vocational training that also Switzerland knows about it, the dual system. These were, I would say, always the field of competencies we have been in. Then after, Switzerland has also contributed to the peace process in Nepal by backstage mediation. And now we are here in Nepal and continue supporting the implementation of the constitution, the federal system, because we believe the federal system will be the condition for economic development, not only in Kathmandu, but also in other parts of the country. And we have seen how it worked well and how it will allow then provinces to develop their own regulatory frame for enabling private sector development. So we are supporting this implementation of the state building. On the other hand, we are still very much in the Tibet sector, in the dual education system, and also migration. We are somehow engaged very very early in safer migration because this is a reality of Nepal and contributes a lot to economic development. So these are the main interventions we do. But what the beauty is from in our setting is we are the development branch, which is integrated in the embassy. We have a mandate of development cooperation, but also a mandate to to defend Swiss interest, and one is also to defend Swiss business interest. So we try really to link these two interests together in the sense that we can support Swiss businesses who are interested with the context know-how, with access to the government, with also liaisoning.
How is it, like, is there any, not to focus, but at least like starting talking about impact investing or sustainable investing in Nepal from the embassy? Is there understanding, awareness about that? Because Switzerland wants to become one of the leaders on the financial circle in sustainability. So how is it somehow coming over to Nepal?
So the mandate from the development cooperation side is to develop impact in investment. You know, this is we follow also the SDGs, and we have now in our new framework agreement, there is a request from the parliament that we invest 30% in climate change relevant fields. So we see that our investment or our effort in impact investment is exactly matching what the parliament has asked us, and where we also see a future for Nepal. This is not only us as embassy, we also see the DFIs, the development finance institutions, such as the Swiss Investment Fund for Emerging Markets. These are not charity funds, these are funds which belong to the government but have an objective to give some benefit out of it. But they also have the mandate nowadays to invest in impact investment. And also the World Bank and other IFCs, they have a huge now pressure from their institution to invest. And we are now in Nepal, just discussing with all development partners together on how to support green economy, how to support green investment, and how to engage with the government on that to allow frameworks, policy frameworks, which just support this trend. So I think it's just the right moment we enter in this discussion with you.
But can I just have one more question?
I wouldn't dare.
We need the ecosystem to develop, which is doing very well, very much. So we need the government to be on board. And the Swiss embassy is leading on an initiative to coordinate all of the development finance institutions from around the world to help the government make it easier for foreign direct investment, to have new regulations for private equity venture capital type funds, which has already started. So I think for this to be a success, it has to be not just funds like ours, it has to be organizations like the Swiss Embassy, who also work with the World Bank. We and all the other funds work very closely with the Swiss Embassy and the World Bank. And I think the most important part of that is the government. So it's been my experience, well, all governments are bureaucratic and have their legacy laws. The government is really willing where it can. What it needs to do is increase investment. It needs to create jobs. And we talked, Ted talked about the reliance of the economy on remittances from jobs abroad. I think the highest impact we can give to Nepal is to create quality, well-paid jobs in the country. Mm-hmm. And that will start to bring people in. It'll start to hopefully create a bit more of a export-import balance. Mm-hmm. So I think that ecosystem is really helpful. But just to that point of why would Tim Gosha, the CEO of an impact fund, where does he want more funds? Surely he wants less competition, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Actually, it's the opposite. The liquidity of our investments or any investments is the most important. So we're now raising a new fund. We hope to do our so-called first close in the next month. What a lot of people ask us is, Tim, that's great. You've made a lot of good investments. How are you going to exit? Now, we have, we have managed to get a good track record on exit so far. But the more funds, especially the more specialized funds there are, the more likely you are to exit. So if a smaller fund invests in a startup, it grows, we might buy those shares. If we grow and there's a specialist renewable energy fund, hospital fund, we're going to be able to sell those shares. So the more funds there are, especially in specialized areas, the more liquidity there is, and the more likely you are to be able to exit an investment, the more funds will come in because they're comfortable and can get their money.
Yeah, that's very clear. You know, in UK is such an amazing example. You know, in UK, I always say ecosystem is much more developed and the government is supportive. And this is one of the reasons why it happens this way, right? So I don't know if UK would be willing to... the government of UK would be willing to share their experience in impact investing with other countries?
Yes, yes. I'm probably a moderately unusual guest for your esteemed program in that I'm a theologian, a religious studies expert, and one of the very few non-Chinese who can still translate classical Chinese for publication and interpretation. I'm a specialist in world religions. For many, many, many years, for 36 years, I've been Prince Philip's religious advisor on the environment, and with him created the whole rollout of programs around the world with the major faiths on the environment, developing environmental programs based on their own teachings, their own practice, their own assets. And when I started in this work back in 1985 with Prince Philip, we sort of thought of the faiths as being useful groups that can bring pressure on governments, on international agencies, multinationals, and so on and so forth, but also as groups that had their own core values in a world which even then was fairly thin on core values. Over the years, and particularly since I was the editor of the first ever State of Religion Atlas that looked at the politics, the you know, what were the majority religions in each country? What were their links with political structures? What was their role in education? Their issues on gender, their investments, environment. That's shifted because we began to appreciate through a survey that we did around about 2000, the extent to which the faiths are stakeholders in the planet. They run 50% of all schools or are involved with 50% of all schools. According to UNICEF, 64% of all schools in sub-Saharan Africa. They run a third of all higher education institutions, universities, colleges, and the such like, more than a third of all medical facilities that, of course, have become so hugely important under COVID are run by faiths around the world. And they are the third largest investing group in the world. And way back in 2001, we first started working with the faith investment groups, saying to them, you know, you've got these core values, how are you putting them into practice? Mm-hmm. And many of them were not actually even doing negative screening then. They might have a historical negative screening, such as, you know, Islam has a ban on usury, although that only really came back in 1973 with the first...
Martin, just for our audience, the ones who are not familiar with negative screening, meaning that you exclude some of your out of your investment scope some companies like tobacco industry, alcohol, gambling, pornography, whatever it is. So you put some criteria and exclude. So this is negative screening. Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Hold on. Thank you. For many faiths, those were based on what they believed. So, for example, with the faiths that banned the taking of any life, any form of life, certain forms of Hinduism, Jainism, and so forth, that then affected what they would invest in. And then we were asked by the United Nations in 2015 to bring together the major religions with the major sections of the UN to look at the SDGs. And out of that, there became an awareness in the UN that the faiths were massive investors. They had not really taken on board the stakeholder role of the faiths. And we were asked to create a white paper for the United Nations and for OECD. That then led to bringing together the major religions in Zug, courtesy of SIA, the Swiss Impact Investing Association, who have been one of our major partners all along, which is how we got to know Svetlana and Ben. And from that emerged a working group in collaboration with the UN to create a new organization that would actually help the faiths do what they should have been doing anyway, which is to be faith consistent in their investing. because the money that the faiths gain from their investments is what maintains the mosques, the synagogues, the churches, the temples. It maintains the schools. It maintains the hospitals. Mm-hmm. It pays for the welfare. It pays for doing the rites of passage. It pays for the great festivals. It pays for some of the most magnificent buildings in the world to be kept standing. But there was a gap between how they got the money, where the money came from, and what they did with it. Mm-hmm. That gap was basically that the faiths were not being faith consistent in investing in line with their values. And so Faith Invest was brought into being at the request of the major faiths in 2019 to help the faiths move into being faith consistent, move their investments into investing in environmental and sustainable projects. And that's why we're also busy creating pipelines of investable projects, why we're very interested in the work that SIA does and that you're doing in highlighting that where are these projects that could be invested in by the faiths because they match the values, the teachings, the beliefs of the faiths. So,
okay. On a very serious note, Martin, you mentioned King Philip's or Prince with whom you have been working.
What is the process? How long does it take Faith Invest to go there, to talk to them, that really the action happens not in 3 years, but now?
Good, very good question indeed. And I mean, essentially, that was the first question we had to answer. How do we create a process where we reconnect faith with its values and teachings, with what it does with its, not just its financial assets either, its land, its buildings, its influence, its power. And we do this in a very simple way. The great thing about the faiths, unlike the United Nations, is that you can go back to core texts within every major faith that tell you what they believe. And so the first task we do, any group that wants to join us, and we did this when we did the first meeting in Zug, and in fact, this whole process is called Zug Guidelines. Each faith group, and we're not talking about the whole of Christianity, we're talking about the Church of England, the Church of Sweden, the Orthodox Church of Constantinople, the Vatican, the religious orders. Each one of them, we say to them, okay, what do you believe? What is it that you actually believe? Why are we here? Why was the world created? What is our role here? How do we deal with failure and weakness and foolishness and sin, whatever phrase you want to use, because whatever we do is always imperfect because we're human beings. So how do you deal with imperfection? How do you deal with aspiration? How do you deal with education and teaching? From that, we then say, okay, these are your core beliefs. And for some faiths, it is that we are called to be stewards of the planet, and it is to be the khalifas, the governors of the planet. For others, is to find our place within the circle of life and to recognize that we are but a part of something much bigger. So define that. Then we say, so given those teachings, what are the values that emerge from that? Detail the core values. Core values in terms of relationship. Well, there are four that the major faiths would all recognize. One is, what is your relationship with the divine? However you understand that, whether that's God or the gods or the Tao, whatever it is, what is your relationship with the greater story? Mm-hmm. The second relationship is, what is your relationship with the rest of life on earth? The third one is, what is your relationship, and this is very much using Jesus's words, with your neighbor? Given that his view of of your neighbor was probably the people you most least like. In other words, it's the whole world, including the really nasty people like Ben, who make a joke right at the beginning of the TV program that I fall straight into, but I forgive him, you see? So you've got that thing. And the final one is your relationship with yourself. And I think an awful lot of groups that are very caring are very good at the first three, but they forget the one about the relationship with yourself. If you are not honest with yourself, then the rest of those relationships are not true. And that's really what we're pushing for. What is it that your values actually tell you you should do? From that, we then say to them, okay, how is that reflected in your investing policy in terms of negative investing? Svetlana, thank you for that brilliant description of what that means. And then finally, given that's what you're against, what are you for? And a very interesting example of that would be that everybody knows about Sharia law, this idea within Islam that there is a series of teachings that say what is not permissible, which brings the Islamic teaching of the ban on usury, and obviously, you know, other key areas of Islamic faith, what you cannot do. We're now working with a fascinating group of Muslim scholars and investors and saying, okay, if Sharia tells you what you cannot invest in, what is haram, as it's called, then presumably, if it isn't banned, it's legal. So we're then saying, stop telling us what you won't invest in and then just investing in a boring way. Recognize that Islamic finance alone could shift the entire financial market if it decided what it was going to invest in order to create the kind of world we want to live in. The same is true with the Vatican, and we're in the process of devising with colleagues a Vatican policy on precisely that as well. So I don't know if that answers the question.
No, there's
a logic. There is a logic, Svetlana, how we get the face to recognize.
But how long in terms of time does it usually take? Like when
About 18 months.
18 months?
18 months.
Oh my gosh, it's quite long.
Well, not really, because although most people think that most religions are run by popes, there is only the Catholic Church that is run by a pope. Surprisingly, most religious organizations are, if not fully democratic, are quasi-democratic and have consultative processes by which decisions are made, because there is a great danger in giving total power to a religious or a political leader. And over the centuries, the faiths have evolved mechanisms for accountability. Those take time. And also, if you want the decision to be real, what you don't want is a religious leader who goes to a conference and says, yes, we will invest ethically, and then goes home and forgets all about it. What you want is that the people who manage the finances have been told this is what they must do, because the structure that is responsible for telling them what they should do for investments has told them that this is the new policy and has said, and we back this with resources, with staffing, and so forth, because the faiths are enormously powerful and complex organizations. And in the same way that you would not expect BP to be able to change within a fortnight, you would expect, well, if we look at the way that BP has taken the time it's taken to start rethinking its policy on fossil fuels and alternative energies, I think the faiths are way ahead. I mean, you know, they're racing ahead in comparison.
Yeah, that's very true. Coming to that, I wanted to ask that since we are now in the midst of this pandemic going on and how, you know, things are changing as everything appraises, so where would your effort be for this year, for this 2021? And what are the sectors you will be looking into? I mean, for example, would you be looking into climate action, forestry, renewable energy? So how would you be operating this year?
Very good question indeed, Ben. We have a whole process called Faith Long-Term Plans. And we first did this with the UN back in 2008, 2009, and culminated in a big ceremony at Windsor Castle with Ban Ki-moon and with Prince Philip, at which 64 major faiths said, these are the priorities that we will now focus on for the next 10 years. Because of all the chaos around COP 26 at Glasgow being postponed, we were approached about this time last year and asked by the UN and the British government, obviously hosting the conference, the COP, could we mobilize the faiths to become an alternative powerhouse driving change, hopefully to support the national government decisions in saying, great, you're doing it, we're doing it also. If the national governments fail, as they did at Copenhagen in 2009, then there is an alternative. We do not put all our eggs into the basket of nation states. There's a very, very good phrase in the book of Proverbs in the Hebrew Bible, which says, put not your trust in princes, Well, I've applied that with Prince Philip, but if you take it to a broader principle of governments, basically don't put your trust in governments. Advice that goes back about 3,000 years, worth listening to, I think.
What would you think if all the religious leaders today come out and say to their believers, to their followers, that please take care of the environment, please take care of your surrounding, please treat the place you live or the world you live in with love? I mean, I'm sure more people will be affected and will listen than to Donald Trump, most certainly.
I hope so. They already have. I mean, one of the great sort of unknown secrets or lost or hidden secrets of the world is the fact that faiths, back in 2009, the UN described the religious programs on the environment as being the largest civil society movement on the environment in the world. We have over 3.5 million faith-based environmental projects at local churches, mosques, schools, as well as international programs. It's just that the faiths get on with it rather than strut around as an awful lot of other organizations do, proclaiming what they're doing. But every major religion has produced a set of core teachings on the environment. Most of them now have environment departments with staff, with expertise, with rollout programs, some more than others. So if we look at the Orthodox churches, for example, they've had a massive program on the environment through all the major Orthodox churches since 1989. Other faiths are still working their way towards this. There is a program at the moment coordinated by United Nations Environment Programme, which is bringing together, I think it's 56 Muslim nations, to create a collective Muslim statement that they came out with a statement on, for example, climate change in 2015, which is really radical and has led already to changes within the investment policy and the energy policy of Saudi Arabia. So it's happening in a way that the faiths know how to do best. We think in generations. Most activist organizations think in 18 months. And what you end up with is a lot of programs that look very good when they're launched and that you hope nobody's going to ask you about at the end of the 18 months because there isn't much to show. Because human nature does not change primarily through threats. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the great problems of the environmental movement has been that we've threatened people. We've tried to scare them into good practice. Now, people will often say, but isn't that what religions have done? No. Of course we've had groups that have become very dramatic and very apocalyptic. But the vast majority of what faiths do is that they walk beside you through the ups and downs of life, through the struggles of life, through the joys of life. For example, I mean, just to take one very simple example, I as you know, Ben, because I sent you my book and you're very nice about it, I actually do a lot about reading religious buildings and landscapes and understanding the sort of subliminal messages that are hidden inside the buildings. And I often say to people, you know, if you want me to read your church, I will read your church. But what it will tell you is that there are something like 7 or 8 different versions of Christianity in this building going back 1,000 years, because it doesn't stay the same, but it evolves in a way that people feel it's still the same. So one of the key things is, if you look at a medieval church anywhere in Europe, it looks like a ship. You've got the tower, and then you've got the body of the church, which narrows down to essentially the prow of the ship. And that's deliberate, because the image of the Christian faith to itself is that we're a ship that will carry you through the storms and through the sailing through this life. It will carry you through the ups and downs. It's somewhere you can go to be protected and somewhere also that will say, let's journey on. And it's also the boat that will take you into the afterlife. So what we need to recognize is that the way you actually move people is by giving them a structure that gives them the confidence to be themselves, but where you adapt and change slightly every so often so that you are able to steer them to perhaps a slightly different destination. Threats don't achieve that. And I think we commented on this last time, I can't quite remember, but you know, we're constantly being told by the environmental movement and others what we can't do, what we can't eat, what we can't buy, what we can't travel, and so on and so forth. And the faith all do that. They all have periods. There's Ramadan, we're in the middle of Lent now, of a lockdown. You simplify. Well, you don't do it for the whole of the year, because the moment you finish Ramadan, you have Eid al-Fitr, and the moment you finish Lent, you have Easter, and we celebrate. And we need that celebratory element. And if there's one thing that the commercial world has learned better than any other agency, is people love to party. And much of consumerism is dedicated to partying. What we need to do is give a sense that you party, but you party because you've already made a difference. That's part of it, I think. But this, so we're here on trial. We are here to see whether we have grown mature enough to return home by being given the responsibility by God as the caliph, the ruler of the world, to manage this planet for him, in the same way that caliphs used to manage elements of, say, the Ottoman Empire on behalf of the caliph. Even within that tradition of the Abrahamic faith, you have very different notions. So there's a beautiful notion within the Orthodox Church. And within the Orthodox Church, they take seriously that we have this unique position of, and it's beautifully described in the Psalms, the great poems of Judaism from about 3,000 years ago, where it says, "Oh God, you have made us higher than the animals and just slightly lower than the angels." So there is that sense that we have, and of course also in the Hebrew Bible, you have that Adam names all the animals, and naming in traditional cultures is that you have power. If I couldn't remember Ben's name, and I would want to say, well, you know the guy who's to the left of you there, Svetlana, what's his name? Ben, that's right. I've already lost his sense that I'm taking him seriously. So the power of naming is enormous. You know the name of something, you have a power over it, and it has a power over you as well. Again, famous stories of Jacob wrestling with the angel and so forth in the Hebrew Bible. So within the Orthodox tradition, there is the tradition, yes, we're powerful, but we're only powerful because we are a vessel, we are simply a channel for God's blessing on the earth to all the rest of life on earth, and the ability of the rest of life to give worship back to God. We are not powerful, but we are simply the empty channel, the tube that brings the blessing of God to the earth. Now, that's a very different notion from we're in charge and we can do stewardship and we can run as we want. So that's within the Abrahamic faith, you have this huge variance. And then really, and I'm going to use a very inadequate term, but within the Vedic traditions, and the Vedic traditions, as Ben knows better than anybody else, those are the traditions that flowed out of the Vedas, which are amongst some of the oldest literature in the world, probably 3,000, 4,000 BC, but which then led to the development of what we now call Hinduism, which covers a multitude of varieties, Buddhism, Jainism, and that view is that we are part of a cycle. Any power we have is usually illusionary, and that actually in the end, this is a world of great uncertainties, whereas the Abrahamic tradition is a world of great certainties. There is God, here are largely his teachings. Whereas one of the things I love about the Rig Vedas is the very first Rig Veda, which is the Rig Veda of creation. And it ends, at the very end, it says, so how did this all come about and why? Who knows? Only the gods know. And then the final line of this poem, written probably 3,500 BC, is, and maybe they don't either.
That is so very Hinduism.
Kevin, would you just maybe tell a bit of your background yourself? You know, we know you are such amazing entrepreneur of entrepreneurs, but what people don't know about you, how would you talk about yourself? Okay.
Well, thank you so much. Let's get started. So I'll do a quick story. You know, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is not a big city. It was, you know, sort of a blue collar area. And my father was a bartender. I'm one of six kids. So I didn't come into the world in any kind of money situation. But when I was 11 years old, my dad said, hey, I'm going to, I've saved up enough money that I'm going to open up my own bar. So he opened Harrington's Irish Pub when I was 11 years old. And for several years as a young teenager, I was working in the restaurant business. But now this goes back because, you know, I'm an old entrepreneur now. So this was actually back in the 60s and the 70s when I was doing this. And I'll never forget, I was working 40 hours a week as a young boy, and I was making $1 an hour. And wow. I said to my dad, there's not a lot of money here. Okay. So you start your own business. Okay. So he mentored me. My father was my first mentor. Mm-hmm. I started a business in high school. Then my freshman year of college, I started a heating and air conditioning installation company, installing furnaces, air conditioning systems, et cetera. I had, by my sophomore year, 1 year in business, we were doing $5 million a year in sales. We had 25 employees, six trucks going out every day while I was in college. And wow. I realized, wait a minute, I can't do both. So I actually dropped out of college. So I'm not proud to say that I'm a college dropout. My mom was very upset, but I think it's turned out okay.
She's happy now, no?
So then one day I'm watching cable television, and when I first ordered cable TV, this is 38 years ago, there was only 30 channels. And as
I thought you were just 40 years old, Kevin.
Oh, hey, I am an old entrepreneur. I'll give you my age. I'm going to be 65 in a few months, okay?
So, really? So
I was around back in the day. But I'm watching the 30 channels, and I got to the last channel, and everything else had programming. ESPN had sports, and CNN had news, and MTV had music. Last channel was Discovery Channel. Nothing was running. And so I called the cable company. I said, hey, I'm not getting anything on channel 30. And they said, oh, channel 30 is a brand new channel called Discovery. They don't have a budget for 24 hours a day. It's only an 18-hour-a-day channel. So I said, wait, 18 hours? What are you doing for the other 6 hours? They said, nothing. It's just going to be bars on the screen. And that's when the light bulb went off. So I said, I am going to fill that time with something. And that's what I did. So as I see, you know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing. And a lot of people before COVID, it was too much about me, selfish, selfish business owners, entrepreneurs. And I think that we now see that we need to be able to collaborate. And I think this is a powerful word that happened for me. As soon as COVID hit, everybody was running and not knowing what to do. But my initial reaction was reaching out, talking to those that are in need, and let's collaborate and let's communicate, and let's get out there. And I think this is what has spurred impact kinds of momentum. Yeah. Because you have to think about your fellow man. You have to be looking out for the universe, protect those that are going to be living in years to come. And so I believe that this is one of the responsibilities we have as humans and as entrepreneurs to focus in sustainable, impactful ways.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where I would like to step in, because I know that this COVID has devastated a lot of small and medium businesses. All over, even in America, I'm hearing in New York, a lot of small restaurants, cafes, they are all completely bankrupt. So what would be your advice to such business owners who are completely now reeling under the shock?
Good. So let me explain a couple of dynamics of what happened when COVID first hit. So you think that COVID hit and you're thinking, what is going to happen? How do I operate? How do I get go forward? So, but this is what physically happened. Businesses shut down. People were laid off. In the United States, it was 50 million people were now had no place to go every day. What did they do? Yep. They stayed home. What did they do at home? They watched television. They went on their computer. So you had this massive increase of viewerships for television and the internet. And then you had this tremendous decline in advertising, because if your business is closed, you're not spending money to tell people to come see you, right? Concerts were closed. Restaurants were closed. Yep. So you have no advertising, massive increase in viewership. What did I do? I didn't stick my head in the sand. I went after customer acquisition. I increased my e-com efforts by 10, because I said, and I started seeing people in my industry, all of a sudden they took and ramped up their customer acquisition. And I say, what is your customer acquisition cost? Your CAC. CAC. Yeah. We call it a CAC in the United States. Okay. What is your customer acquisition cost? I know it's funny. It's just little terms we use.
I know this one. Yeah. We also use it.
Yeah. So I said to myself, I had a product that was running $18 to acquire a customer for a $30 item, which was a little high, but we were okay with that. But once COVID hit, we sped it up. We got that down to $5 customer acquisition. We'd never seen numbers like this in years. I think the key thing is I want to spend my time on businesses that have the greatest upside, but that are also thinking about the world and the impact of the sustainability also. When I look at an opportunity or a business, I often want to see like a business plan. Okay. Not everybody has a business plan, but if they don't, I like to see a little, at least executive summary, mini plan or something. Yeah. And so when I'm looking at a business plan, I like to see that the company is also incorporating the sustainability into their plans. I love to hear that green is good, and that's the way to go. And I think this is what is powerful. And by the way, there's one other thing I'm going to mention about that, because people that are raising money, companies that are raising money, a lot of times, where do you go? You go to friends, you go to family, you go to angels, you go to bankers, hedge funds, et cetera. But there's another thing that people are doing very successfully, and that's going to crowdfunding. So I'm involved with some crowdfunding ventures, and sustainability and impactful businesses are doing very well on crowdfunding because people have a chance, the crowd, to invest and be part of it and tell the story about the sustainability. And so I'm involved with more than a dozen campaigns, and this one of the companies I'm involved with is called Republic.co. And if anybody out there spending time, right?
I have a challenging question to you, Kevin. Just came into my mind.
I don't know.
So you have all these TV shows, a lot of people watching you around the world, and the awareness about SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, and impact is not yet there. So how could we incorporate that into your shows, maybe somehow, that besides selling all these products, we could also raise awareness about impact, that people would change the consciousness slowly? What do you say?
Well, so I think it's a great idea to do that. One thing to understand, because when I first started filming Shark Tank, and I've done 175 segments now. So when I first started filming, I said to the producers, why do you have so many projects that come on Shark Tank that seem a little goofy or don't seem like anybody would really want to invest, okay? And they said, I'll never forget, Mark Burnett, who came down, and he said, nobody's invested any money. This was like, it was like 11 o'clock in the morning. We'd been filming mm-hmm. 8 a.m. And he said, nobody's invested anything today. What's wrong? And we said, Mark, what deal would you have invested your money in? Okay. And he says, oh, he says, what? You got to understand, we need to make good television. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now I'm not the producer of the show, Shark Tank. I was a guest. I was a shark. The producers mm-hmm. have, you know, they cut a deal to get distribution on ABC TV, but they can't just, it can't all be about education and where things that we should be doing.
We could choose a project, you know, the project.
They have, to entertain, okay?
Yeah.
Could they?
It's magical transformation also, you know, impact. Yeah. Wow, we solved climate change. Yay. Something like that.
This is what I'm going to recommend, though, to the producers. I think if they were to do one show that said, okay, today's episode is about sustainable and impactful businesses, would be a great idea. That this is what it's all about. I mean, we have challenges with various things that are happening to the earth and the warming problems that exist. So, I mean, how can you show that the efforts of your business are creating real change and have real viability? And now when you can have a company that's growing, that is creating real change, people want to be involved in those kind of companies. They want to be shareholders of those companies. Yep. They want to be on the board of those companies, et cetera. And this is what I'm looking for. As an investor, are companies that, I've built 20 businesses to over $100 million. That's great, but that's the old way. Now I want to build 20 businesses to over $100 million that are sustainable and impactful for the world.
So dear all, like all good things, this season just ended. And I'm really happy to start the new season soon. So Ben, who is going our guest on the 9th of April?
9th of April, we are having an amazing guest. She's the head of the UNDP's Global Nature for Development Program, which highlights the contribution of biodiversity to sustainable development on the community and national level. So looking forward to seeing you all next week, Friday.
Very happy Easter to all of you and act with impact. See you next week.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can we use finance and force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing and how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.